From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for March 18th, 2022. The Bucks have a couple of home games this coming week, and the Brewers' spring training games start today. It's National Forgive Mom and Dad Day. For example, forgiving mom and dad for getting you beat up in school because they had to give you a cool first name like Ezekiel. Okay, the world is coming to an end. No, it really is. And I have proof. Millions of Jaru spiders have invaded the southeast coast. These are palm-sized, bright yellow striped spiders. They scatter to the wind by making web parachutes, allowing them to fly over 100 miles. Entomologists predict by this summer, they'll swarm the entire east coast. Parachuting spiders. Still believe that the end is not near? Well, how about this? The Texas giant red-headed centipede is also on the way. It's venomous and 8 inches long. The head and first two body segments are red, and the rest is black with yellow legs. And any of its 20 legs can secrete poison with its feet. And it snacks on lizards. But there is an upside. It's in Texas. Our Econ 101 lesson for today, boys and girls, is inflation, deflation, shrinkflation, or whatever you want to call it. For example, the price of a bag of Doritos is the same as before, but there are now 5 fewer Doritos in each bag. This saves the company 21 cents a bag. Now multiply that by 200 million bags of Doritos. So class, Frito-Lay is generating how much extra revenue? Let me help you out. The correct answer is a lot. And finally, let's go to Florida. By the way, thank you, Florida. You make my job so much easier. Two 30-something naked drunken sisters, not nuns, were fighting it out in the streets of Orlando. The cops arrested them and gave them something to wear, like matching orange jumpsuits. How appropriate. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kilb, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreesing. And wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you, Max. Much admiration for getting out the 30-something naked drunken sisters. That's a tough one to get off the tongue. Plenty to be happy about this week beyond the headlines Max pointed out. I think, you know, take a look up and down the markets. There's quite a bit to be pleased with. The NASDAQ up 8.2% this week, almost pulling itself out of correction territory, now down 11.1% for the year. But, 1,050 points this week is a nice big rally for those tech-heavy growth stocks. The S&P 500 up 6.2%, closed today at 4463. For the year, the S&P now down 6.1%. Recovering from correction territory, and the Dow up 5.5% this week, up 269 points today to close at the bell, 34,750, now down 4% for the year. The benchmark 10-year Treasury up a pretty big step this week, finished last week at 2%, now closed this week at 2.15%. That's a quick look at the week. You know, Brian, I think first and foremost, got to point out just how strong of a rally we saw this week. I think reasonable for investors to ask questions about what this really means about where we are, given some of the challenges we've seen. And I think, you know, my take on this, at least, is that we've been waiting for news from the Fed. We got it this week. And there haven't been a lot more surprises. And so in the absence of any real new surprise, I think the market has been able to digest the uncertainty that's out there. Prices were starting to look kind of attractive all of a sudden. And so you get a little bit of a rally inside what is some pretty considerable uncertainty that remains. What are you taking away from kind of this week? What are you taking away from what's going on in the markets right now?
Well, I think to some degree, Kyle, this week is an extension of the last couple of years, which is to say, you know, not just COVID and not just Ukraine now, but the series of challenges we've had along the way, which are many and significant, and in some cases historical in nature, I continue to be surprised and pleased at how resilient the markets have been. You know, and I think we've talked a little bit in past shows about kind of the technical significance of the S&P being around 41, 4200, and you know, of how, and I think a lot of different ways, that's a pretty interesting place in the market. And we've bounced several times on some pretty rough days off that area now. And this week had quite a rally, you know. And I think if the Fed captures as much of our attention as it seems to in the last couple of years, and you would look at this week and you'd say, well, okay, what did we just do? We just announced a rate hike and potentially six to follow, and the market went up. I think you'd have to kind of say to the Fed, you know, the jury's out on whether policy-wise that's the right answer or not, but certainly from a communication standpoint, you'd have to give them a ton of credit for not rocking things when we're kind of hit an inflection point with interest rates and are going the other way. So yeah, you know, amongst all the bad news and the caution and the concerns, boy, I tell you, the market's been resilient and it's been strong.
So, Brian, is that just an extraordinary resilience, or is that just what we should expect the market to be?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't know, but I think my I think my answer or my self-explanation perhaps is, you know, you could compare our situation to many cycles over the past, but I think what's unique about this is everybody that's got a job, that wants a job, has one. You know, and when people are at work, they're spending money. And we know that consumer spending makes a big chunk of what drives the engine of the U.S. economy. So I think that puts a bit of a floor on things, at least for now. You know, inflation's an issue and could be an issue, and that may become a challenge in the months ahead. But for now, I think there's some downside protection in that people are getting paid, people spend money. That means companies make some profits. And, you know, we could talk about this in detail, but corporate profits the estimates for the year have actually been going up in spite of all this stuff, which is astounding, I think. So, yeah, there's challenges out there, but I think the market's reaction is once again kind of pointing to the underlying fundamentals, the foundation of the economy still being strong.
You know, Paige, I think you have done a lot of looking this week at kind of the changing earnings forecasts that are out there right now. You look at the forward P on the market right now. Despite, again, a 6%+ rally for the S&P this week, we're still below 20 in terms of forward PE. Yeah, we had been down below 19 for a short period of time, but a forward PE below 20 and a forward earnings yield of north of 5% still looks attractive relative to the 10-year treasury, relative to what you could do on any, you know, other number of safer investments. And it's certainly far better than the yield that you can get just buying S&P stocks. And so, you know, I think encouraged that this week we saw a little bit of a jump in the earnings forecast, even if it's not coming from the places that, you know, we might hope, it's coming from some places that I think are somewhat obvious as investors maybe are digesting some of the pain at the pump.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, anytime we've talked over the past few years, all we ever talk about is how the market is a little bit expensive, how it's trading at a higher PE than its historical average. And while it still is, to your point, prices have gone down, earnings have gone up. And so that's really what's pushing the PEs down. Now, if it was the opposite, if earnings were going down as well, then maybe we'd have a little bit of concerns, but that's just not the case right now. And I think right now, especially in the markets, there have been big, big moves in U.S. markets so far this year, largely in response to what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. And while we all agree that's a horrific situation that nobody should have ever had to deal with, the reality is that a lot of U.S. companies have very little direct exposure to Russia. So it's less about what's actually happening there and more about the fallout. But adding to that, as Brian pointed out, that we, you know, have some monetary policy shifts, but the outlook is generally stable and it's something that we can plan for. You know, noting that economic growth forecasts have gone down a little bit this year, but not enough to really drive the market down further. The biggest thing that I'm looking at right now is the fact that this type of volatility and when stocks go down, where, you know, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to say, that leads to opportunities. And so right now, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but it's just a great time for active management. When you look at the S&P 500, you know, sure, it's a cheap exposure to a lot of names, but you're going to get the ups and downs regardless of whether or not they are a quality company with quality earnings. And right now, with the uncertainty surrounding commodity prices, it's not enough to just be listed in the S&P 500. You have to have that good corporate management. And we're going to start to see those companies shine through this volatility.
I think what I appreciate about the Russia-Ukraine conversation in particular is that we have some pretty hard data on what exposures look like from, you know, an earnings perspective in terms of S&P companies, from a, you know, economic perspective in terms of global GDP. And yet I think the conflict or this war has exacerbated something we've been talking about for the better part of the last couple of years. And that is, you know, this decision to take greater control over supply chains, this decision to bring manufacturing back here to the U.S. Brian, we talked to a portfolio manager out of Columbus a couple of weeks back now, and they were quick to point out what Intel's doing, spending billions of dollars bringing semiconductor manufacturing. There's going to be semiconductor manufacturing taking place down in Texas. I think, you know, that's one of any number of things that I think long term is a pretty optimistic point for the U.S. economy, for a more sustainable supply chain as COVID and, you know, global crisis and any number of other things continue to kind of rain on our parade.
You know, Kyle, I think it's way too early perhaps to start talking about the impacts of the war in Ukraine right now, but certainly that's something that emerges as a key theme in terms of, you know, for the last few decades, this kind of march overseas for cheaper labor and cheaper goods may now be replaced by the need to control the supply chain, right? And your comments about Intel building plants in Germany, right? $35 billion for two plants in Germany. And yet here domestically, Intel announcing at the beginning of the year, they were going to build a plant in Ohio. Just tells me all kinds of different things about how we might reinvest in our own industrial productivity. And it has long legs, I think. There's all kinds of ways to start talking about increases in the trades and what impact that has on education and you know, what different partnerships may end up coming out of this thing or being destroyed out of this thing. And you know, to Paige's point, it's horrible from a humanity standpoint, but we may get some, you know, return to domestic production and stronger strategic relationships as a result of it. And that's something to keep an eye on as we move forward, I think.
Brian, one thing just to add to that is, you know, there was a study done by a macroeconomic firm a couple of years ago where they found that U.S. companies only save about 10% by making products overseas or in China. And so at a certain point, you know, as you have the rising middle class in China, as wages are going up there, and we have all of these additional issues from a supply chain standpoint, you know, that just stacks on the risks. And sooner or later, corporations are going to start asking whether or not it's worth the risk to save that 10%, or if they can find that investment here and fill the gaps and save money elsewhere.
And I think we need to be clear that it took decades to offshore those jobs, and it's probably going to take just as many decades to bring most of them back, if that's even the direction we had. I think what is more likely to happen is that we will find critical pieces of supply chain, critical pieces of infrastructure that we need here. We'll continue to rely on production in other areas of the world as well, but maybe diversify that a bit more than just strictly China or Taiwan or, you know, parts of Malaysia that maybe, you know, could be under threat either from weather or these types of events we're facing now. And so I think critical to understand that this isn't an overnight solution. And as part of that, I think there's a pretty long runway for potential opportunity here that investors should be paying attention to. You know, I think the challenges of the higher multiples, the higher prices that we've seen, you know, somewhat offset by the longer term growth prospects we get from bringing production back here to the U.S. you know, Joel, as we look at the week, you know, from an economic perspective, some interesting releases this week, what stands out to you?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, it supports what everybody's been saying so far, that especially the Brian's discussion of the fundamentals. We've got some really strong things going on in the economy, and we had indications of that this week. Housing starts were the highest they were since June of 2006. Housing under construction is the most since 1973. And just think about that. That's pretty astounding. The industrial output, that's a big thing to look at. That was the highest it's been in 3 years. Here's one, and this gets to Brian's point about the employment outlook. So continued claims, usually we talk about initial claims, new claims for unemployment insurance. So continued claims are those who not only filed this week, but 3, 4, 5 weeks ago and are still receiving claims. That was the lowest number since 1970. So, there's some really strong indications of the fundamental strength of our economy.
You know, I think we look at the housing market as such a critical piece of what ultimately consumers end up spending on. And it's one thing to look at home starts or homes under construction. I think it's another to look at homes that are already out there and how sales are going there. And the data there has been a little weaker recently.
It has. And it gets to the whole, supply-demand equation and how that balance is always shifting in some markets, and that's the case for housing. So for years, housing's been going great as far as sales are concerned, and the National Association of Realtors has been complaining we don't have enough houses out there to sell. The demand is so great that we don't have the houses to sell. So I just said that we've got more houses under construction now, since 1973. Well, now the National Association of Realtors is saying, well, we're not selling as many houses anymore. So the from January to February, the number of houses being sold dipped by 7.3%. But now we've got other things. Now it's just not the shortage of houses. Now it's more the fact that shortage was causing high prices. We've had 120 months in a row. So 10 years, every month for 10 years, the year-to-year cost of housing has been going up. The median cost of a house right now is $357,000. Brian was just talking about buying his first house for 89 or whatever, although that was a long time ago, right, Brian?
That was a long time.
So the realtors are saying high prices and now the rising mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are now above 4% for the first time in 3 years. So those are starting to make houses less affordable. So fewer people are out there buying.
And of course, you could look at the alternative to buying houses, and rents are going up as well. And so I think, it shows up in the inflation numbers, not as quickly as maybe the price of gas does, or not as quickly as maybe the price of food does. But, we are seeing those inflationary pressures across the board, even if the non-core pieces, the energy and food prices, have been kind of the bigger component so far.
That's right. And I think a lot of people are seeing prices go up and feeling that. I think they're also hearing about and seeing in the news the fact that we're at, highest inflation in 40 years and whatnot. And we're getting reports, as we got last week from the University of Michigan consumer sentiment number, that people are afraid of inflation, that's a big and growing fear that they have. But it's a show and tell sort of a thing where they're telling us they're afraid of inflation, but they're showing us that they're still willing to buy, because we had numbers this week on retail spending, and that's now at an all-time high. It went up again in February, not as fast as it went up in January, but people are still out there. And one of the indicators of that is bar and restaurant spending. It went up 2.5% just in February, and I think it's up 33% from a year ago. So that's one area where people are feeling that they can't spend money or they shouldn't spend money. That's an easy place to cut back. And we're still seeing that grow.
I think the place where a lot of this just kind of crisscrosses is if you go back to inflation in the 70s and the 80s, and it was kind of a thing where the economy wasn't going anywhere and things were expensive and a lot of people didn't have jobs and some people could afford things, some people couldn't. But now it's pretty much everybody that has a job wants one. You just can't get what you want to buy, right? You know, and commodity prices are certainly on the rise. And as this relates to housing, right? You have a bunch of people looking for a few houses, but to build the houses now it costs a whole lot more because lumber is getting really expensive. Labor is not available in the trades and whatnot. And it just, there's a lot of different cross currents going on in the housing market, which is why I find it kind of a fascinating focus for the next few years and how we're going to pull through all these things. But I'm guessing that at some point in time, what the last couple of years has taught us perhaps is that there are some things we don't need. There's some things we do need, and we're going to focus on those. And a lot of our buying patterns are going to change, I think. And, you know, maybe we'll have a better appreciation for what we have. And maybe quarterbacks and wide receivers won't be paid so much somewhere down the road. I don't know. We'll see.
That, of course, on the heels of the Packers trading Devontae Adams.
Sorry, maybe, I couldn't help it. Sorry.
Maybe a bitter place to end the podcast this week. Maybe on a positive note, just a reminder that, you know, I think this is the kind of week that reminds you why you stay balanced. It's the kind of week that reminds you that you don't simply run away from the concerns that are out there in the market, because we can be surprised, I think, significantly surprised this week by just how meaningfully positive stocks can get, despite the fact that we didn't get a lot of resolution this week. You know, maybe you know a couple of your tournament picks are out now, and maybe you know that Devontae Adams isn't going to be back with the Packers. But as far as markets are concerned, not all that much has changed. And yet, you know, we're talking about plus 8.2% for the NASDAQ, plus 6.2% for the S&P. And again, even the Dow's up 5.5% this week. So with that, something maybe happy to hang our hats on. As always, we enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.